rearrangement this morning. As you can see in the room, there was an unfortunate amount of vandalism that was done last week. So we are proceeding with what we have. You will notice that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is not sitting on my right side where she usually does sit, and she's not feeling well, so she'll be watching us through Wisconsin. We don't have our usual ability to court conference as we've had in the past, partially because the vandalism got our sound system as well as a number of other things. So if she has questions, she's going to email them to the marshal, and then the marshal will read the questions so she can participate kind of in a combination of matters. So we have two matters that are coming before us this morning. The first one is Rule Petition 1911, and Attorney Schwarzenbach, I take you are the presenter, correct? Okay, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Rogensack and Honorable Justices, my name is Paul Schwarzenbart. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Madison, and I think, as most of you know, I've been working on disciplinary cases in one form or another for about 35 years, and had the honor of being appointed to and serving on the OLR Review Committee. I'm here to present Petition 19-11, which was a product of the Charging Process Subcommittee, of which I served as the chair. As a preliminary matter, I would like to recognize the service of the subcommittee members who worked with me in taking the lead on what became Petition 1911. Those include Attorney Mike Apfelt, who is here in person today, as well as Attorney Chris Sobek, the Honorable Carrie Schneider, as well as ad hoc members, Professor Mike McChrystal of the Marquette Law School, and attorneys Bill Weigel and Julie Spoke, both of whom are now division administrators for OLR. Before I get into the specifics of what's presented on 1911, I would like to share with the Court some of the things we looked at but did not put in the petition. That was particularly, we did take a look at the role of the Preliminary Review Committee and whether or not the time spent by OLR preparing to submit matters to the PRC was something that would be something the Court should be thinking about, whether or not the PRC's role is something that that impairs the efficiency, effectiveness, and fairness of the OLR process.
Well, a dictator is always the most fair. One person makes the decision. Like what he does, it's most fair, but certainly it's always most efficient, right?
That is true, Chief Justice Rogensack. And we did look at the PRC, and what we concluded was, and we got a lot of input directly from Keith Saleen on this, as well as through the ad hoc committees who were on our subcommittee. And basically what they told us, and they were fairly adamant about this, is they felt the PRC review does fulfill an important function for the OLR, and particularly in forcing the agency to do a good job of preparing the grievance process, honing the investigation to get it ready for litigation if and when charges are filed. And I think that there have been some improvements made recently, particularly with what's called the PRC complaint system, where litigators are involved prior to submitting a matter to the PRC, which greatly speeds up the time between a matter being referred out to litigation, whether to a retained counsel such as myself when I serve in that capacity, or the litigators in-house with OLR. Typically, we will now be able to get a complaint filed within a week or at most 2 weeks of getting the cause to proceed determination from the OLR, whereas in the past, I can speak from my own experience, it was a considerably more difficult process to go from an investigative report and turning that into a complaint. To have that done in advance of PRC review, I think, has been very helpful and has helped that process. And I think also should, in most cases, result in a complaint which is more likely to be not in need of amendment as the case goes forward. So the bottom line is we did look at the PRC's role, and after getting a lot of input from it, we concluded this was something that fit the category of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And we were, I think, satisfied that some of the tweaks that have been done have fixed the delays to the extent they were caused by having to submit investigative reports to the PRC. Moving on to the recommendations we actually did make, the first three subjects in sections 1, 2, and 3 of the petition are basically all similar. They deal with giving greater notice to and explanations to a grievant in the event a matter is closed. So the first section deals with a situation where a matter is closed by the or at the stage, at the intake stage, and the change that we're suggesting is that if the director affirms closure as recommended by the intake staff, that a brief written statement of reasons be provided to the grievant, so at least the grievant has some information as to why OLR.
Doesn't Mr. Saleem do that now? I know I get things when they complain that he has a violation of his office because he did dismiss something, but those records always include a statement from him about why the OLR decided not to proceed.
What we found is, yes, what we're doing here is we're suggesting that the rules be amended to conform to practice. And, in fact, OLR has been doing that. So all we're suggesting is have that in the rules. When somebody succeeds to Mr. Saleem, you know, right from the bat, they know that that's part of the job.
I know, and he's threatened me that he is going to retire, too.
He's younger than I am, Your Honor, but he doesn't have much more years to go before he hits the retirement age. So change will be on the horizon in the next few years, I would expect. But in any event, I think sections 1, 2, and 3 all reflect basically codifying what has been existing practice to give greater notice to grievants when a matter is closed at any stage. That a statement of reasons be provided. That has been what the OLR has been doing, and we're suggesting that the rules reflect that.
Okay.
Moving on to section 3, actually sections 1 and 2 are the notice thing. Section 3 is another tweak at the intake stage, and this is dealing with consent reprimands. Our subcommittee is suggesting, and we don't know how often this would potentially be used, but that the rules provide for the ability of the OLR director to negotiate a consent reprimand at the intake stage if it's appropriate. Now, there may be some situations where the facts are so clear and there is no dispute of facts that a respondent may be motivated to say, hey, I recognize I made a mistake. I want to put this behind me. Let's get this done before sending it out to a formal investigation because there's nothing to investigate. And if the OLR director agrees, why not have that tool available in those instances where it might be appropriate? In Section 4, again, this is kind of tied to the look we had about the preliminary review committee process. What we're proposing here is that, again, with the consent of the respondent attorney and the director, are there situations where they might agree to waive presenting something to the preliminary review committee and simply proceed to the next stage of the process where matters can be resolved under in the methods suggested by 22.08 sub 2, which may include going directly to filing a complaint. Again, we don't know how often that a respondent might be motivated to say, let's waive sending something to the PRC and going through that process, but at least in situations where a respondent may be motivated to say, okay, I recognize something's going to happen at the PRC level, let's not waste what may be a couple of months in this process toward moving it along. We can agree to waive the preliminary review committee in some cases.
Is a consent reprimand based on probable cause?
After a PRC review?
Well, you're saying allow the director to enter into a consent reprimand prior to conducting an investigation. And my question is a consent reprimand based on probable cause? And if it is, I don't see how it all fits together.
Well, I would think it's based on probable causes determined by the director, but not necessarily being. I don't work internally at the OLR, so I'm not the person who is best equipped firsthand to analyze how this happens. But I think that consent reprimands do not necessarily depend upon something being referred to the PRC, that can be done after an investigation.
That was the suggestion. It says enter into consent reprimand prior to conducting an investigation. So to me, that means prior to a determination by the PRC. And then my question to you was, well, is it still based on probable cause? Otherwise, why are we having people get into any kind of an arrangement for not conducting themselves in an ethical manner?
Well, I think the...
Wouldn't that more likely be the situation like you were referencing when someone might come in and say, look, I made this mistake, I need to take responsibility, I want to move forward, I want to avoid the time and expense that would be required for you to conduct a full investigation and go through all the hoops, and I just want to take my punishment and move forward?
I think that's what we're trying to get at here is, the issue of probable cause, the way it's set up with PRC review is the PRC makes a formal finding of cause to proceed. I think in this situation we're saying there's an agreement, there's a consent between the director and the respondent attorney that, yes, if this went to the PRC, there would be a cause to proceed finding here. Let's waive that step. Let's just get to the outcome that we can see is going to proceed here, and let's get it done. And again, we won't know until this would be in place how frequently this might be used. I think it's significant, though, that the state bar has not spoken up against this, and I think, in fact, they support this as an alternative. And Dean Dietrich is here, and Dean can perhaps speak to his perception as to how frequently respondents might be inclined to consent to these provisions in the event. Section 5, I think I had misspoke. Sections 1, 2, and 5 go together, and this is the written statement of reasons. It appears in Section 5, and that would be at the close of an investigation where the PRC, the OLR, finds that it's not going to proceed further. It's going to dismiss the matter. It's not going to take it to the PRC. And in this situation, again, we're proposing that the rules reflect what has been the practice. In sections 6, 7, and 8 are another set of three sections of this petition that go together, and they relate to diversion agreements. And it's really a very simple thing that we're proposing here, but it requires the three different sections to achieve it. And that is, under the current practice, if the OLR negotiates a diversion agreement after a matter has been submitted to the PRC, but before the PRC has met to review the investigative report, in the event there was a claim that the respondent attorney had breached the diversion agreement, the matter would basically end up being litigated before the PRC as to whether or not there was a breach. Our subcommittee looked at this, and one of the first things we asked was, how often does this happen? And I think what we were told is hardly ever. It's maybe happened once or twice. And as part of our looking again at the role of the PRC and looking at this specific rule, what our subcommittee concluded was that the diversion agreement is really a matter which we believe, if you look at the rule, is something that's committed to agency discretion, so to speak. It's something where the OLR director has concluded that for the reasons stated in the rule, we may have a violation here, but it's not of sufficient import or it has not caused sufficient harm that of some sort of formal disciplinary finding is appropriate in this situation. And instead, what we're going to have is a diversion agreement, typically something of an educational or monitoring type arrangement where the OLR works with the attorney to try to make sure that this the error isn't repeated. Because we view that as something that's committed to the director's discretion, the way we looked at it was whether there's a situation where the director believes the respondent attorney is not living up to the agreement, why are we turning this into essentially a breach of contract situation and having the PRC act as a court in this situation? We think it's best dealt with as a matter committed to the director's discretion, and therefore what we're proposing is that rare situation where an alleged breach may occur after a referral to the PRC, that we simply take that out and have the situations where the director believes there's a breach dealt with the same way whether or not there has been a matter referred to the PRC. And again, there's a process to provide the respondent with an opportunity to respond to the director's concerns about alleged breach, but basically it's something that ultimately is the director's discretion. The remaining sections of the petition are basically formal provisions to address situations regarding waiver of a matter to the preliminary review committee. These deal with an amendment to SCR 22.11, dividing it up into three parts, and I think it's self-explanatory there what we're trying to accomplish just in terms of clarity in allowing the director to move forward. Are there any questions from members of the court? I'm ready to address them.
Yeah. Well, we thank you very much for your service. I know that this has been a long process, much longer than I anticipated or Judge Patak anticipated when I talked him into chairing this committee, and I'm sure longer than you anticipated when you agreed to participate, and we do very much appreciate all the work that you put in and the time and your efforts, so thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, members of the court.
Dean Dietrich, you're the next guy on my hit parade.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Dean Dietrich. I'm an attorney in Wausau, and I appear here today before you on behalf of the Board of Governors of the State Bar of Wisconsin. It is rare that I come and appear before this court and indicate to you that I have nothing really to say but an agreement to proposals being presented here. I will respond to the questions discussed earlier by indicating that there are occasions, not very common, but there are occasions where an attorney will indicate to the Office of Lawyer Regulation, yes, there's something here that's a problem. Let's reach an agreement. Let's do a very quick resolution. So it does happen. Quite often, it's a suggestion by respondent's counsel, and sometimes the OLR counsel is not willing to go that far in the process. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I thank the court for considering this matter. I thank the special committee for its work in presenting these options and making these changes. What's noted in these particular changes is some level of communication of rationale to the grievant. I know that will take more time for the Office of Lawyer Regulation, but I certainly believe it improves the credibility of the entire investigation discipline process. So I'd be willing to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Patak.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rogensack, justices. For the record, I am Gerald Patak, a reserve judge and chairman of your OLR Procedure Review Committee. On this petition, I have nothing to add other than obviously we are the petitioners and support the petition. I would ask for the court's permission at the end of today's proceedings to be able to make a brief statement in conclusion, since this seems to be the last day, at least for maybe a year or two, that will be before the court, and I just have some closing comments I'd like to make with your permission.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you so much. Mr. Celine, you're sitting back there, so you're fair to pick on. Do you want to come up here and tell us what you think of this petition, 1911?
Yes, Chief Justice. I'm Keith Celine, the Director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. The proposals in 1911 are all things that OLR believes are appropriate and the court should incorporate into the rules. So we support the changes that have been proposed in this petition.
Is there probable cause before a consent agreement is entered into, made by you or your staff or someone?
Right. There are two things I think the court should think about here. One, what is the practice at OLR at this point, and what do the rules provide for? With regard to OLR's practice, it is a decision that the director is making that there is probable cause to enter that kind of an agreement, and OLR would consider the evidence in the case and have a belief that the violations that are being proposed in any consent reprimand could be proved. With regard to the rules provide that that a consent reprimand under Rule 2209 can be entered after a formal investigation and without consideration by the preliminary review committee. It's one of the options the director has after the investigation is complete in 22.05. It could also be something proposed after the PRC. Moving it and including that option after the intake process, I think, provides us a more efficient way to work through things that appear to be very clear at the beginning and to which the respondent consents. But the rules in themselves do not require any review of that, and they don't establish a standard for OLR to enter an agreement. I think the rules rely on the fact that the respondent would be required to agree to the violations and the facts that are stipulated in the agreement. So in terms of what the rules provide, there is not a requirement for a finding of probable cause, but in practice, and I think in the practical way that the system will work, there is a process in place that our practice is such that there will be a determination by OLR that there is probable cause.
So before a consent agreement can be approached with the lawyer, OLR will have made a determination that there's probable cause to proceed, not going through the PRC, I understand that.
Yes, Your Honor. Exactly.
Okay. My concern was when lawyers receive a notice from the Office of Lawyer Regulation, it strikes terror to their heart, okay? And some lawyers are tougher than other lawyers, and I wouldn't want them to get a notice where your office and you, as the head of that office, haven't already determined that you believe there's probable cause. Okay, so I don't want people to be stampeded into consent decrees when your office hasn't taken the steps necessary to have a foundation for a disciplinary action.
I understand you. Thank
okay.
you.
And I am assured by what you say that that is not how it operates.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So there's no place in the rule that requires that, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's committed to the judgment of the director.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any questions of Mr. Celine? Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That concludes all of the witnesses on my list and one voluntary witness here. Is there anybody else that would like to speak on Rule Petition 1911? Okay, since that being the case, we'll close the hearing on that and move to 1912. And Attorney Apfelt, I think you're up to bat on that.
Chief Justice Rogensack, other members of the court, may it please the court. I will try to keep this as short as possible. We're dealing now with proposed changes to Rule 20:8.3, that which governs a lawyer's duty to report the misconduct of either other lawyers or judges. The current rule requires a lawyer to report misconduct of another lawyer or a judge if only if the lawyer knows that the other lawyer or judge has committed a violation that raises a substantial question as to that lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. The proposed changes are to both the text and the comment. The proposed change to the text of the rule lowers the reporting threshold from knowledge to a reasonable belief. And the proposed change to the Wisconsin comment would require a lawyer who consults with a client about reporting the misconduct of another, and consults because reporting often requires the disclosure of information that would fall within the definition of a client confidence. Anyway, requires such a lawyer to refrain from discouraging a client from consenting to disclosure unless the lawyer reasonably believes there's a reasonable possibility that it would compromise the attorney-client privilege or otherwise prejudice the client. Now, there are also a couple of other very small changes to the comment which reference another ethics opinion and another rule relating to reporting misconduct, but these are not affected by the threshold of the rule itself. Now, the reason for the proposed change is simple. Many lawyers look for reasons to avoid reporting misconduct. And knowledge is defined as actual knowledge of the fact in question in the definition sections of the rule. Knowledge is such a high threshold that a lawyer can almost always rationalize not reporting. And if a lawyer cannot somehow rationalize it on this basis, he or she can almost always discourage a client from giving permission. Although lawyers could still choose to report misconduct, even if not obligated to do so, as currently written, the opinion of the committee was that it lacks effective compulsive force in many situations.
Do we want more lawyer reporting other lawyers? Do we believe there's misconduct going on and one lawyer sees another and knows that what's happening is very unethical and refuses to do anything about it?
I believe it happens. I do believe it does. Now, mind
how
you,
often?
It's impossible to quantify that. But I will tell you that the impetus for this rule lays in my own experience in a consultative capacity, largely within my firm, as well as the anecdotal evidence of some of my counterparts at other firms over many years of experience here. It's not a huge problem. And there is nothing in either this rule, as it currently stands, or the proposed rule that would prevent a lawyer from reporting on something less than absolute knowledge. And keep in mind that the knowledge or reasonable belief, as the case may be, that we're talking about here, is not only of the violation of itself, but of the fact, proposition, possibility that it raises a substantial question as to the lawyer's effects. So the Board of Governors has opposed this change on the basis that the current knowledge standard, and I quote their letter, provides appropriate direction, close quote, and further that a standard based on reasonable belief, quote, will create confusion and uncertainty, close quote.
On that point, could you give me an example of an attorney having a reason to believe there's been an ethical violation that does not arise to the level of knowledge?
It is not... It is difficult to think of this, to come up with an example in terms of a, say a gross miscitation, the conveyance of a threat, although threats can be veiled. But there are other conditions of lawyers, for example, impairment, in which you will never have absolute knowledge. Likewise, even when the violation itself is clear, whether or not that the violation is isolated or, conversely, it raises a question as to the lawyer's honesty, et cetera, in other respects, is very similar, difficult.
Is this similar to suspicion, this reason to believe?
It's a reason to believe as defined in the rules. I would think that a lawyer facing a mere suspicion would probably wait until further evidence was forthcoming, if ever it came forth. But a reasonable belief standard is not a standard with which lawyers in this court are unfamiliar. Reasonable belief is defined in the rules. It is used throughout the rules. It is rife in our jurisprudence. So while I would suggest that there's no question that these proposed changes were meant to lower in some small way the threshold of reporting, I would respectfully submit that the reasonable belief standard is no more unmanageable than an actual knowledge standard.
Would the reasonable belief standard require a reasonable belief with respect to each element of the suspected ethical violation?
I would think so.
Is there a concern that it could be through hearsay, though, that someone might report? And I'm thinking about situations where people have said something to me, like, did you hear that this judge is acting this way? I could say, yes, I've heard that from more than one person. Does that give me a reasonable belief to then have to report something that really is hearsay? I mean, that would be my concern.
I guess it depends on the situation. But if you hear this from a dozen of, you know, your respected colleagues, and it's all hearsay, nevertheless, that seems to be something that might be appropriate for OLR. I mean, it's not as though any lawyer can go out and unilaterally decree that someone is guilty. All this is a duty to report to OLR, another organization that's charged with evaluation, investigation, and all those due process requirements. Or in the case of a judge, the official counterpart.
It's an interesting rule in a lot of respects, because one person's perception of whether they reasonably believe a judge should sit on a case or not could be very different than another person's reasonable belief of whether that should happen. I'm thinking of a few cases as a trial judge particularly when the lawyers are a little on the acrimonious side, they'll come to the court and they'll say, Judge, I want you to kick this lawyer off this case. I think they have a conflict, or I think they have a... This would require them then to actually report that to OLR. It happens. It's kind of interesting how this could be used as a sword, I think, and tactical positioning. Do you see that, or you think that's just not a concern?
I think reasonable belief is still a standard that has meaning. And again, it's reasonable belief as to both the violation itself and as to the likelihood that it will affect the lawyer's ability in other respects. I will also tell you that while I understand the perspective from which you're coming, the motivation here was really as the reporting the misconduct of lawyers. Judges, I mean, with all due respect, were something of an afterthought, since we realized that the rule used the knowledge standard in relation to both sorts of violations. Could it be misused? Well, of course. But a knowledge standard could be misused, too. And someone who is inclined to mischief will not, under not even the current rule, would discourage that person. Remember, this is a reporting requirement. It's not a reporting prohibition. You are entitled, even under the current rule, to report on something less than absolute knowledge.
You know, our staff has indicated that they were unable to find any other state that used reasonable belief as the test for required reporting. Did you find any other state that perhaps we missed?
I must confess I did not. I admit I did not find, and I I personally did not look, although I believe someone else on the committee may have.
Okay.
Fine. This would not be the only respect in which our rules have departed from the ABA standard. I mean, perhaps the one that leaps to mind first is the mandatory duty to report otherwise confidential information.
Can I pick up on the question that Justice Ziegler was asking, going back to the hypothetical of a trial judge in which one of the parties has moved to disqualify the judge, let's say for a conflict of interest? The standard for filing the motion would have to be reasonable belief, right?
Oh, I would, a reasonable basis in law, in fact, yes.
Okay. So if he moves to disqualify the judge, wouldn't this changed standard also require him to report the judge?
Sub B of the proposed rule, sub B of the rule even as it exists relates to reporting judicial requirement. Judicial misconduct. Mm-hmm. And since the same standard is currently used in the rules, the committee felt that if there would be a change in the standard applying to attorney misconduct, it would apply to judicial misconduct as well. But it does not in any way affect the underlying pleading requirements and other factual thresholds that one must meet in order to fulfill your duty in other respects. I simply don't think that this is a license to fabricate under any circumstance.
Well, I'm not so much worried as a license to fabricate as much as I am if the threshold that you have to satisfy to file a motion to disqualify is close to the standard that you have to that you are required then under the ethical rules to report the judge, I'm concerned about that every motion to disqualify would also have to be paired with a report.
I don't know that every I think I can say with relative certainty that motions to disqualify were probably not in the center of the conversation leading to this proposal. But a judge's refusal to recuse him or herself, or a response to a motion to disqualify, denial of a motion, is certainly not necessarily indicative of a violation of the rules. It may be indicative of a difference of opinion about how a standard applies, but I mean that's not always a violation of the rules. I would hope the vast majority of time it's not.
I got a question. From what I understand, Georgia does not have any. They advise reporting, but they do not require it. And this is just more of a big picture question. Obviously, the real question here is regulating the conduct of law and lawyers, and ensuring that we have people practicing who are ethical and not hurting the public. So there's a question of whether the mandatory reporting accomplishes that purpose and does a good job of it, and whether enhancing that and requiring more reporting will, in fact, do that. In some respects, it's an empirical question we don't know how to test, but we're all working towards the same goal here, right? And there's a philosophy that's underlying the proposal that says if we require more reporting, that is going to produce better outcomes for the practice of law in Wisconsin. But not all states follow that model. And I guess I wanted to ask if there's any support that you could offer us for the notion that what we're doing is far superior to the alternative of not reporting or requiring reporting in all circumstances, and why, in fact, a more stringent requirement would serve those purposes, taking into account the costs and benefits, right? If you're required to disclose, that it has some costs as well about people's maybe willingness to talk and those sorts of things. So curious as to your thoughts and response on that.
Well, as I think I indicated before, I have no empirical evidence in front of me, and as I think you noted yourself, it would be difficult to generate that. I would say that, a priori, if we trust in the system, if we believe that the entire system of discipline has some ability to reduce future incidents of violations, then necessarily enhancing a reporting requirement would tend in that direction. But I will stand here and I concede that I think that the difference, even if you could measure it, will undoubtedly be small. This ultimately, if you go back to the beginning of this committee, I believe that one of the reasons that we were asked, underlying reasons, to take a look at the rules as a whole, all of the rules, it was multifold, but one of them was a public perception that the bar, and I would probably have to include within it the judiciary, is something of an insular and perhaps self-protective organization. And this is a one unique, small, but decided way of reinforcing the principle that members of the bar and officers of the court cannot turn a blind eye to misconduct. It's very small, I admit that. But it is a real distinction. There is a distinction between knowledge and reasonable belief, both as to the violation itself as to the likelihood that it may cast doubt upon the lawyer's adequacy in other respects. The system will not collapse if this change is not made. At the same time, I don't think that this change threatens the system in any great respects. It is, again, it's a reinforcement of the principle that we take misconduct seriously and that we will do something to allow the greater disciplinary system to engage a problem when we perceive there is a problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Dietrich, you are back on my list again.
May it please the court. I come here today as representative of the Board of Governors of the State Bar of Wisconsin to speak in opposition to the proposed change to SCR 20:8.3. I do not speak in opposition, nor does the Board of Governors speak in opposition to the change being proposed to 1.83H3 or to the comment being proposed by the committee. The comment provides clarification regarding the activities that a lawyer must assess when dealing with the applicability of 8.3. If the comment is intended to address, we would not support the sentence that talks about reasonably believes. We would not support that, but the ending couple of sentences we would think clarifies the considerations by a lawyer in these settings.
In your written submission, you indicated that lowering the threshold introduces a standard that would be confusing. Why do you believe it would be confusing?
I believe it will be confusing for a couple of reasons. First of all, I've always maintained that reasonably is in the eyes of the beholder. And the concept of knows is found in the model rules, and I believe found in all other state rules. I don't believe there is any suggestion of a difference in any other state. And there is ability to rely upon, to look to consider what the model rules say and what is said by other cases when you're dealing with the same language. If we go to a different set of rules, I believe that Wisconsin lawyers will be left really without much in the way of guidance on what does this mean. I need to go a step further. Justices, I am regularly contacted about questions of a duty to report. I'm pleased to say it's not frequent, regular. And I walk through a lot of the analysis that you find in the comment, and I walk through and try and give advice to the lawyer on what does it mean to know that there has been a violation of the rules. I hesitate to say this, but I will be truthful. If this rule passes, I'm going to have to pause and think whether I'm going to continue to provide that advice to lawyers. Because now you're creating a standard that says reasonably believes. And if I advise a lawyer that, no, I don't think there's a reasonable belief here that there's been a violation, that lawyer could be prosecuted. And somebody could say, no, there was a basis for a reasonable belief. And I'm not going to be in a position to be causing a lawyer to have a problem like that. Now, is that likely? Probably not. But it is certainly something I have thought about in my capacity. I believe that the standard of reasonably believes is subject to all sorts of case decisions in all sorts of other areas, and yet we would have nothing here. I believe Wisconsin lawyers would not have guidance from the model rules if this change is made, and that will be a challenge for Wisconsin lawyers.
You know, it's kind of interesting just thinking back on the motions where you have a lawyer trying to disqualify another. If that lawyer currently files that motion, the lawyer has to have some sort of good faith belief. Otherwise, you can't ethically file the motion, right, in court?
Right.
So then I think that looks something like this. Lawyer A files the motion trying to disqualify lawyer B. Lawyer B doesn't think that lawyer needs to be disqualified, so lawyer B would then file against lawyer A saying you filed a motion without a reasonable belief, right? So they both would be required under this rule to, if you're going to defend against that, file ethical complaints against each other for the fact that the one lawyer filed the motion that the other lawyer thinks wasn't filed in good faith.
It at least creates the potential for that scenario to occur.
That's not confusing.
I'd like to close my comments and answer any other questions by quoting from learned counsel Paul Schwarzenbach, who spoke to you earlier today. I think he gave you some very wise words. If it ain't broken, don't fix it. We are following a standard that is applied in all other states and under the model rules. There's nothing here to suggest that Wisconsin lawyers have been failing to consider their duty to report. I've unfortunately had the occasion on, I think, three different occasions in my career on behalf of counsel, of an attorney, to report an attorney because we felt the standard existed and we had to take action. It happens. To create an environment where now reasonably believes is open to all sorts of interpretation, my fear is that this is going to create more situations where this so-called threat of reporting is used in litigation settings, as the justice has suggested, to simply obfuscate the matter. Any other questions I can answer?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before I get to you, Judge Patak, I'm going to see, is there anybody else who hasn't signed up that would like to speak for or against Rule Petition 1912 that hasn't talked yet? Okay. Judge Patak?
No.
Oh.
Judge Apfel to respond.
Oh, all right. Very good. Fine. Attorney Apfel, that's
good.
Fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to respond very quickly to two things Mr. Dietrich said. The first is that the fact is that at present, a motion to disqualify filed by one lawyer against another lawyer, or other motions that implicate the basis, the reasonable basis for one lawyer's position, are perhaps not routinely but very commonly met with counter motions. The current rule doesn't prevent that at all. It's going to happen one way or another. It's not a pretty sight, but it does happen. The second is, I will represent to you that in the course of my career, I have clearly been aware of situations in which lawyers have relied upon the strict standards of the reporting requirement to decline to report things that the system would probably have been better off had they been reported. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Judge Patel?
And I'll just make one brief comment as it relates to 1912, and that is we work throughout the system to always make things better. And if we have a system that's working well, we still want to work to make it better. And I think that's what we're trying to do here with Petition 12. I don't agree with the adage that if it's not broken, don't fix it, because we can always make things work better if we have a system that needs and can be improved upon. All right? That being said, this might be the last time I appear and reappear as your committee before you. I think the only thing left on the agenda could be us coming back in 2021 once you have decided to reconsider the petition that's left hanging based upon the referee's role. And we may see you then, we may not, depending on how you decide to handle that, and I appreciate that. But I want to say in conclusion to these hearings that while this has taken longer than we expected by my clock, it's about 3 years and 3 months now, we want to thank you, the members of the committee and all the people who worked on this project, for the opportunity to be able to involve in this important process, to have input. And we thank you for giving us this opportunity and for your openness in letting all these people weigh in, if you will. I also personally want to thank all the people who served as members of the committee and all of the subcommittee members, including many ad hoc people. We really reached out and tried to make this process as open and inclusive as we could. And I want to personally thank people in the room who have worked on this, including the commissioners, Julie Rich, Dave Runke, were particularly helpful to us. I want to thank attorneys Apfelt and Schwarzenbart, who are chair or involved in the committee and worked on this. Marsha Vandercook, not Marsha Vandercook, I'm sorry, Marsha Mansfield, here and was our recorder and is a professor at the law school teaching ethics and looking at retirement, regrettably. I also want to thank Keith Saline and his staff. They were always with us at the table, always available to us, always providing us. We sought out to be able to answer questions that we had. And I also want to thank Dean Dietrich, who has given us his expertise. He appeared before our committee at one point in time based upon his personal expertise. He's also worked with us as the chair of the State Bar's Ethics Committee, which he no longer does chair. But it has been an inclusive process and open, and I want to thank you for the opportunity and thank the members for their service. The other thing I wanted to point out that we still have to keep in mind that this is really an important process we have to tread very carefully and be mindful of the fact that we are lawyers and we are self-regulating. And to make sure that we maintain a viable, credible system, it means that we need to reach out and be inclusive. And one of the things that I fault myself for in this process and not being as inclusive as we perhaps could have, is looking to the public, to the consumer, to the grievant. And I think we need to keep that in mind. And while there are some things we've suggested that aren't necessarily rules we're popping on the table before you to consider, there are things in our report that we've recommended that be done that would be addressing the needs of the consumer. So that being said, the top hot topics that you should keep in your mind that you've heard Keith Saline talk about and that we've talked about in our process are two things. One, consumerism, that is the grievance, the public, the consumers of legal services. And the other is more distant and remote perhaps, but the idea that you've heard about where leaders in this area who are on the cutting edge, maybe the bleeding edge of this process, are looking at changing the process to rely more on lawyers to become more self-regulating, placing responsibility on law firms and so on to be more closely monitoring the conduct of their lawyers and playing a more important role in that regard. Those are the things that are coming down the pike and that you should be aware of and should keep in mind as you go forward here. And the final thing I'll say is, while we're done with our work at this point, there are things yet to be accomplished based upon our report, and I pledge the energy of myself and members of the committee to help you complete the effort and to do whatever is necessary to accomplish those goals. But again, thank you very much for the opportunity, and we look forward to making more progress and improving the system as we go on. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you know, the court's thanks to you, Judge Patak, and all the members of your committee. We could not do all of the things that are necessary in a sphere like regulating lawyer conduct and serving the public without your assistance. It's just a huge job, as I think both of us found out with this process. So, and thank you very much for your willingness to stay connected with the court if problems come up in this area as we look at your full report and work through the last of the petitions that are before us. We appreciate that very, very much. So thank you so much on behalf of the whole court. Okay, I don't have anything else that is on my hit parade for this morning, but the court is going to meet in closed conference in 10 minutes to talk about court security. We've had some problems here, and we need to get together and really carefully consider them with our marshals. So we will meet with our in closed conference. Thank you.